The story I always got as a school kid was that Aboriginal people had this beautiful and rich culture, and that their bushcraft was so good that they could live as hunter-gatherers, living more or less nomadically, taking food and water as they found it. We were told that Aboriginal people created no permanent dwellings, that they didn't bother to cultivate the land because they didn't need to, that they didn't build dams, and that they never had the technology to do any of these things anyway. But it turns out all of this just isn't true. And the evidence has been right under our noses all this time, right there in the reports written by the early European explorers and surveyors, and in the archaeological records. And in those reports, a very different picture starts to emerge. There are detailed descriptions of large villages and spacious domed stone houses. There are descriptions of networks of dams, nets to catch fish. There are fields crowded with haystacks, lines of yam plantations. There are ploughs, and there are even grindstones to make bread. One stretch of cultivated land was thought to be so fine it was likened to, quote, a gentleman's park. And these things were reported all over Australia, from Queensland to Tasmania to WA. Bruce Pascoe is a writer and an historian. Bruce has brought together the research of people like Rupert Gerritsen and Bill Gammage, and he's done his own rereading of these early accounts of Australia. Bruce has written about all this in a beautiful book called Dark Emu, Black Seeds. And Bruce says the time has come to reconsider the old hunter-gatherer label. Hello, Bruce.
How are you going?
Oh, thanks, Bruce. We're going to start with the mission of Charles Sturt, the famous Charles Sturt. Can you just explain a bit about what his mission was?
Charles Sturt was one of the more competent Australian explorers, and he was charged with heading up into the north from Adelaide, looking for the inland sea, which people were obsessed about at the time, hoping to find something which would enrich the new colony. And he didn't find it. Like all his other fellows who'd been looking for the same thing, they didn't find it. But what Sturt did find was something that saved his life, and that was Aboriginal people in the very centre of the continent. When Sturt found those people, he was virtually dying. Some of his colleagues had already died. Many of the horses that were accompanying the party were dead, and they were virtually in their last couple of days of life.
They were climbing these sandy ridges, weren't they? These big, heavy sandy ridges near the Warburton River.
Yeah. They went on and on and on. You can see them from an aeroplane, and they're very distinctive from the air, but on the ground they're less romantic and more vertical. And he was struggling to get up and down these dunes, and every one of them was taking more of their energy, more of their life. They got up to one, and they were hailed by 350 Aboriginal people.
What, in the middle of the desert?
In the middle of the Sturt Stony Desert, there were 350 Aboriginal people who had been using the river valley to grow grain. They hailed the explorers. Sturt talks about their courage in watering a creature they'd never seen before, the horse. And then they offered the explorers roast duck and cake, like a civilised afternoon tea.
Sorry. This is roast duck and cake in Sturt's Stony Desert. They were offered that to eat.
The Aboriginal people there weren't living on the bones of their behinds. They had a successful agricultural economy. They were sowing grain into the ephemeral stream bed of the Warburton River. When it was ready for harvesting, they would come to that area, harvest it, turn it into flour, and live a very rich physical and cultural life. And Sturt was fortunate that he met them, because they were able to keep his party alive. And Sturt was a good writer, and he wrote all this down. And he wrote with great warmth and respect for the Aboriginal people.
I've just got to get into the details here. Cake. What kind of cake?
Well, the people were growing a grain. We don't really know what it was, but I suspect that it was millet. And we've ground that grain into flour and made bread from it. And it has a very distinctive flavour. And Sturt talks about it being the lightest and sweetest cake he'd ever eaten. Now, a dying man is likely to exaggerate the quality of whatever he's eating, but Sir Thomas Mitchell said the same thing. They always talk about these cakes as being the best they'd eaten. And we have 1,000 cooking shows in Australia today, and no one ever talks about these old cakes.
What happened to Sturt and his men after they'd been given water, roast duck and cake?
Well, they were there for some days in order to recover, and Sturt fell in love with the society to a certain extent.
Where were they put up?
They were offered a new house in the estate. There was a group of three new houses that had been built, probably for people who were yet to arrive at the river. And they were given kindling. They were given all the means they required to feed themselves and be comfortable. And Sturt talks about the evening falling and all the fires starting up and the sound of the grinding stones as women ground grain into flour for that night's meal. And he said it was the most civil of communities.
Why don't I know about this story? It's there in black and white, is it? And in Sturt's account, why don't I know about this, Bruce?
Well, I went to university and I studied history and I didn't know about it either. So Australian education has a bit to answer for. And I think that after a while of not knowing these things, it was easy then to replicate that lack of knowledge through our educational system. But the first instance when we began to forget these things must have been a deliberate part of the policy to denigrate Aboriginal life and therefore prove that Europeans could take the land with immunity. That's the dark side of that question, and you could go into ever-increasing darkness following it. But there's not a great deal to be gained from that, except the knowledge that it happened. But the other side of that question is to say, well, what can we do about it now?
See, that wasn't the frame I was taught about Aboriginal culture in Australia. I was taught, given it more in the 1970s, it was a bit more like, oh, these beautiful, perfect bush people who and it was a kind of a noble savage type education that I was given about. So when you read these accounts, it just doesn't fit the picture that we grew up with. It doesn't fit that frame, does it?
No, and it wipes Aboriginal people off the economic board, because it means that we're just going from one bush to the other bush to collect a berry here and a fruit there and a kangaroo there. But that wasn't what was happening. Aboriginal people had a much more organised economy than that. There was obviously bush bananas and things like that being harvested opportunistically, but there were large-scale operations where people were sowing seed, watering it, harvesting it in a very organised fashion with organised labour, organised tools to accommodate that operation. And our school system never taught it to me, and as a teacher I never taught it to my students, and it's a great shame. I didn't arrive at this out of my own brilliance. I was dragged kicking and screaming to this knowledge by Aboriginal people who were offended by my ignorance.
How did you stumble onto this larger story here of Aboriginal people farming the land before the arrival of Europeans?
I'd written a book called Convincing Ground, which is about the contact history of Australia. And after that, I was contacted by a lot of Aboriginal people, which was a great joy, that Aboriginal people were interested in the books that I was writing. And they were providing information that they'd heard from their grandmothers and grandfathers about how things used to be in the Northern Territory and Northern Queensland and places like that. And I found the story unbelievable. Like most Australians, I found it hard to equate with my education. So I went back to the libraries, I interviewed Aboriginal people, and I came up with a story which was so different to my previous knowledge, that it was really hard to accommodate. And it was a bit confronting because I saw myself as a reasonably intelligent person, and yet I'd swallowed the thimble and pea.
I suppose you could read that account by Sturt, and you could read that in black and white on the page, and you could say, well, the guy was so grateful. He was perhaps inclined to exaggeration, and how on earth could anyone have a cultivated society out there in Sturt's stony desert? But how often do you see these stories popping up here and popping up there and popping up all over the place?
Well, they're all over the place. I had to select stories to represent different regions of Australia, but what's in the book is a tenth of what is available. And since writing the book, people have introduced me to new areas and new events, new photographs, which prove that this was general right across the country. It doesn't mean to say that Aboriginal people were living an English life in an agricultural village. It was more complex than that, because people were travelling around in between crops, and it's an Australian agriculture. It is equipped to suit the soil and the climate, and we can learn a lot from it. And if we don't, then we're just being bloody-minded.
The pictures you've got in your book come from illustrations from some of these explorers of things and surveyors of things they've seen. To me, they remind me of, I don't know, the kind of illustrations and descriptions I've seen of medieval Viking agriculture on the other side of the world.
Well, it's a good example because these villages must have been very, very habitable. Mitchell talks about the Aboriginal village with envy because he's riding a horse in the rain, and Aboriginal people in the towns that he passes through, and he passes through four in 4 days, each of 1,000 people each, and he's envious of the warmth and civility in those houses. And once again, this is not something we learn in our history, but it is something we need to know, because it says a lot about how Aboriginal people were occupying the country.
Now, you mentioned there Thomas Mitchell, and there's an account given by him. Explain a bit about him, the kind of man Thomas Mitchell was, please, Bruce.
Well, he was, like Sturt, he was a really good bushman, a great horseman, a great writer. He could also draw, and we're grateful for that because he's given us some brilliant drawings. But he was also a little bit of a hothead, and he fought the last organised duel in Australia and shot his opponent's hat, which apparently was the end of the fight. he was that kind of man. He would have been very interesting to ride a horse with, because he would have been full of story and great company. But he, the thing that is most important about him is not just what he saw, but the fact that he could write about it so well, and his journal survived. And he talks in great detail about the systems that Aboriginal people used to grow grain.
What kind of systems did he see?
Well, he saw the large scale harvest. He rode through 9 miles of stooked grain. So that's a harvest 9 miles wide.
You mean like hay bales, you mean, essentially? Like
these
bales.
Are...
Haystacks.
Yeah, they're haystacks. They're stooks. One of his fellows said they looked like an English village that he'd come from. And it was so familiar to him, because he understood immediately what had been going on and why the grain had been stooked. It was stooked there for drying, so that the grain would separate from the stalk and they could harvest the seed. And he was aware, and so were his fellow explorers, aware of what they were looking at. The funny thing is that they were also prepared to supplant it with their own culture. Sturt's brother was riding 2 days behind the exploring party, pecking out land. Even though Sturt was enthralled by this culture, he was getting his brother to peg out land behind him. So the English were quite ambivalent about what they intended to do in the country.
Does that mean if there's great big stooks, as you're saying, of the grasses there, that doesn't sound like subsistence agriculture? That sounds like there's surpluses being created there.
And Rupert Gerritsen wrote a book about the origins of Australian agriculture, and he talks about surplus as being one of the indications of civilisation. Aboriginal people were not living from hand to mouth from one dawn to the next sunset. They were putting aside preserved foods for the future. And storage was one of the very important indicators of that. People were able to store water by damming it. They were able to store food by creating silos, stone silos in some cases, clay silos in others, sewing up grain inside kangaroo skins. Explorers saw all sorts of different storage systems so that people could have grain later in the year, grind it into flour, and have that food right through the year.
Normally when you're telling the old-fashioned story of the development of civilization, you look at Mesopotamia, Tigris and Euphrates, there's agriculture, then there's a surplus. And the surplus is when you get culture coming out of that, because people now have the time to indulge in cultural practices. This is what we see in Aboriginal culture at the time too.
Well, certainly the harvests were associated with culture, but I think culture possibly existed a lot earlier, before Aboriginal people were creating surpluses. But also in those other countries where the surplus existed, it was sometimes commandeered by an elite. And that's when you get kingdoms established and princes and currencies and the kind of society we have today. And yet in Aboriginal society, the great discovery really wasn't flour, but government. How to govern a people without impoverishing half the population? How did Aboriginal people come to a consensus right across the nation that they wouldn't impose themselves on someone else's land and that they would cooperate in growing food for each other?
Do you have an answer to that question?
I think the answer will be within studying Aboriginal culture, listening to Aboriginal people, and coming up with a modern answer. We're not going to go back to the old way, but we have to utilise what is good for the country, good for Australia. And these plants and the growing systems that Aboriginal people employed are good for the country. They're environmentally sound, economically sound. You don't need extra water, you don't need extra fertiliser. These are things which are going to be an economic boon for our country. But we also have to remember that there's a cultural and spiritual side to these plants.
And a political side to it as well, as you say, which is all intertwined with it at all.
Yeah. And when we separate the spirit from politics, we make a mistake. I always thought that separating church and state was a great idea. But Aboriginal people didn't do that. How they grew food was part of the culture and was part of the spiritual response to the country. And we perhaps need to do that again. I don't want to ennoble the savage, which that's been done, and it was cruel. But we do need to look at successful civilizations. And I believe there's been no more successful civilization on the earth than this one.
Do we know anything about the kind of grain that Aboriginal people were harvesting in these areas you're talking about here?
Well, one of them is millet, Microlina stipoides, and we've ground that into grain and made bread from it. We're looking at another grain at the moment, Haemophilus, which some are talking about as being a superfood, but I'm harvesting kangaroo grass at the moment, and I'm trying to grind that into grain. We're looking for a miller to help us with that, because we see the reference to kangaroo grass all over the place, and Aboriginal people were obviously grinding that into a flour and cooking it. So not only do we need to know how to harvest the plant, turn it into flour, we need the recipe. And that's going to be really exciting for Australia. And, you know, I can imagine new cooking shows talking about these old recipes with some sort of interest.
Yes, it could be the new quinoa, couldn't it?
Well, I hope that... Look, people are going to make money out of this. There's no doubt about it. And some of them will be non-Aboriginal, some of them will be Aboriginal. I just hope that everybody remembers that these grains evolved in Australia with Aboriginal participation, and that it should be respected as and a part of Aboriginal culture.
You're saying evolved, you mean like they were kind of domesticated grains? Domesticated by Aboriginal?
They're definitely domesticates, because some of the characteristics of these grasses are that they all ripen together, and that happens when humans harvest over a period of thousands of years, harvest the grains at the one time and plant them at the one time. So the grain gets used to that system and responds to it. That's domestication. And that happened to a lot of these grains, also to the tubers. We're growing yam daisy at the moment, and it loves being interfered with. It loves being cultivated. And that's because that's how it grew up.
How about rice? Were Aboriginal people growing any kind of rice?
Yeah, there was penny worm in the Northern Territory, and the Aboriginal organisation in around Kakadu, looking at a rice which has obviously been cultivated by Aboriginal people for a long time. And it's a very sturdy rice. It doesn't need as much water as Asian rice, and is probably the parent of Asian rice. We don't know that for a fact, but that's the way the science is leading. And this is going to be an incredibly important plant. And it delights me and our community that Aboriginal people are leading this research.
You mentioned there were grain and grinding and flour and bread and cake. What kind of grindstones have been discovered by archaeologists?
These are pretty large flat stones, and they're found everywhere. I went for a couple of long walks out of Alice Springs, and I found two. Just under a tree, and both the mortar and the pestle were there. And I thought how fragile our history is, that these were just lying around out in the open. But perhaps they were not unused. Even then, in 1993, these were still being used by Aboriginal people.
How old does some of these grindstones get?
We know that one of them was 32,000 years old. And
32,000 years old.
No, and that's just one stone, and there's been very little study of their age. The potential is that they could be 40,000 years old, and even at 32,000 years, turning grain into flour is 15,000 years before the Egyptians tried it. We are the world's first bakers.
The world's first bakers were Australians.
Mm. And she was a woman.
How do we know that?
Because Aboriginal women did the grinding. So not only did she grind the flour, she probably came up with the idea.
Oh, this stuff.
And I love to think about that lady and think of her awake in bed at night going, what am I going to do tomorrow? I think I'll invent bread.
This is just doing my head in now, Bruce, at this point. Now, the first bakers in the world, according to the archaeological record, were Australians, Australian women, way back when, 15,000 years, as you say, before the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians making bread. That's not known either, Bruce. That's not well known. I don't know that at all. You mentioned storage of grain there. In stone silos? Or is that too big a word to use?
They were small silos, but they were drilled into existing granite cavities, and a system was used to exfoliate the stone to enlarge the cavity. Old reservoirs of this flour and grain have been found, ossified now, of course, but showing the technique that was used. And I've even come across a loaf of bread that was taken out of an Aboriginal oven about 200 years ago. And I'm fascinated by this bread because I want to analyse it so that we can work out what grain was used and what recipe was used to cook it. I think this will be great news for Australia. The fact that loaf of bread exists in a Queensland museum after all this time is a fantastic thing for Australia.
This is something we ought to be proud of.
Well, Australians, when they go overseas, won't talk about Vegemite and the Hills Hoist and the cricket team, but they'll say, hey, look, I come from the country that invented bread.
Yeah, what about the stuff we smear the Vegemite on?
On ABC Radio, You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Today I am with author and anthologist Bruce Pascoe. Bruce has written many books, one of which is Dark Emu, Black Seeds, the story of Aboriginal agriculture that was prevalent all over this country before the Europeans arrived in 1788. We know this because it's described in black and white by the notes and accounts and eyewitness reports of the explorers and surveyors of Australia from the 19th century. Bruce, I want to pick up your story at the moment because it's a little bit relevant to this, or more than a little relevant to all of these revelations we're getting today. You grew up in King Island, between Tassie and Victoria. Was that life like for you, your early life there? What can you remember of it?
Well, I loved the island. It was a boy's paradise. You could walk everywhere from one end to the other, fish wherever you felt like. So I thought it was a wonderful life. My mother wasn't quite as enthusiastic.
Well, tell me about your childhood pet there.
I had a kangaroo. There was a lot of roadkill on the island, and no one seemed to worry too much about it. But one of our neighbours kept on bringing home these joeys and trying to get people to raise them, and we raised one. And for want of something better to do, I taught it to jump over dustbins and over the garden fence, which Mum was really happy about.
How did the joey relate to you?
Well, it had fixated on me because I nurtured it. And
so you were like its mother then?
I was. And he must have thought I looked like his mother too.
Well, you didn't have a beard those days, did you, husband?
No, but if I had, it wouldn't have gone astray with a kangaroo. But it was a beautiful animal. And one day it just up and left, and we would see each other in the bush from time to time. And there was that curious gaze between us, but he was a wild kangaroo and obviously had a better life than I had, and he stuck with it.
How did you end up one day on King Island in very close quarters with a bird?
My father was a bit of a travelling man, and we lived in a lot of places, a lot of houses. I went to a lot of schools, and he went over to King Island to work in the mine, and thinking that that'd be an advance for the family, certainly an advance for me. But I had access to the whole island. I just walked. My neighbour said I never walked. I just ran. And, you know, often you'd get caught in the rain because it is Bass Strait. And one day I was camped underneath a bush. And it was one of those revelatory moments in my life, in a way, because there was nothing I could do. It was pouring with rain. I had a T-shirt and shorts on, and I had to stay dry somehow. I got underneath this bush, and my jeans were fraying at the bottom. But no one in King Island knew any better than that, so it didn't matter. And a blue wren started to take the threads from the bottom of the jean and make a nest. And I was enthralled. I just watched this process of building going on, of the process of destruction and building, and I never forgotten it. It had a huge impact on me, even though it was such a little thing, such a gentle thing, and of seemingly no consequence. It never left me. Always in the back of my mind.
Did it have something to do with the fact that the blue wren didn't mind you being there and wasn't alarmed by a human presence?
Well, I think humans can bring birds to them, or birds will choose to go to humans that represent no harm. And my stillness, I suppose, attracted the bird, and he could see an advantage in keeping company with me. That is, I had threadbare jeans, and that was an advantage, and I wasn't going to harm it. And the loveliest times of my life are when birds ignore me. They just walk past me, sit beside me, cock their head to get a better look at me, they have no fear. And I think when you're in the bush and an animal sees that you represent no fear, it's a wonderful moment because you really see the character of the animal, and the animal obviously sees into you.
How did you notice that there were some gaps in your family tree, Bruce?
I knew that from when I was about nine, I suppose. There was a woman who lived in my street who claimed to know about my Aboriginal family, and I found it a bit upsetting, and I didn't know how to react. She got a bit angry with me, for she thought I was snobbing them, the Aboriginal community, but I really knew nothing about it. I was being called nigger at school, and where did that come from? I had red hair and pale skin, so people seemed to know a lot more about my family than I did. And even then, I didn't do much about it. I could have pursued it with that family, and I didn't. When I was about 17 or 18, my uncle got me a job working on the trucks in the trucking company that he worked for, and he told me that there were black sheep in our family and that one day he would introduce me to them. And I was working on fish trucks going between Melbourne and Eden, and he did in fact introduce me to some men at Lake's Entrance in a fishing boat who he said were my cousins. And even then, at 17 or 18, I didn't have the sense to ask them their names. It wasn't until much later, around the time when he got sick and died, that I began asking more detailed questions. And by the time I was 32, I had a daughter who was six by that stage, and beginning to ask questions about the family. And I realised then that she wasn't going to stop asking those questions, and that I owed it to her to find out a little bit more. And it's been all uphill since then.
Why do you think your mum's parents wanted to keep shtum about all this?
I'm not sure that my mother knew much about it. I really don't think mum knew much more than I did. I think my father's family were a bit more aware, because my father's family also had an Aboriginal connection. And part of that connection I didn't find out about until 2 years ago. I'd been following one side of that family story, very rich, very interesting, you know, our whole family story. Like most Australian families, is a microcosm of the country's history. And ours is, an old European connection married into Aboriginal families. And it's very rich, but I didn't know how rich it was until all this other information started coming in, and I was starting to be contacted by cousins from branches of the family I had no knowledge about. And that's been a wonderful thing, because I've got contacts with parts of the country I didn't think I had contacts with wonderful people that I didn't know before, and we're all Pascoes and Smiths.
Here's that Viking connection again, but a lot of Aboriginal people I know have these really complex maps of ancestry that they grow up with, that they're taught in their minds, and there's little positions that are left. And did you have a position in some people's, I don't know, in family, in your Aboriginal family members, in their relatives, in your relatives, in their minds, that was reserved for you, like a place in the kind of web of ancestry? Was there?
There were certainly people looking around for our family. I made the mistake of going through the conventional route, looking through the genealogy of local shire councils, and also ancestry.com, that sort of thing. And they're more or less useless, because all they rely on is the British record. And if you're relying on that, you're not going to find Aboriginal connection, because it was so unpopular to be Aboriginal that people were more likely to hide it than not. And that had certainly happened in my family. But Aboriginal people have this incredibly rich and detailed knowledge of family. And I became so obliged to Aboriginal people. People say, you know, why do you identify being as pale as you are and not finding out about it until your teenage years? And I say, because I'm obliged to those people. They helped me find my family. You know, what do you do? Thank you for introducing me to my family. See you later. You can't. You're obliged to those people, but I'm also very attracted to the story they have.
Is it a really obvious thing to see this connection too, Bruce? I mean, it seems now like so much of, well, this work and is all a part of a process of finding out a kind of secret Aboriginal history that's not immediately visible on the surface.
No, and I, because of my obligation to those old people, many of them are dead now, I doubted their story, and I shamefully went to the library to check up on their facts. So once I had been assured that they were absolutely correct and that I had insulted their knowledge and intelligence by checking up on them, I was obliged. I was obliged to find out about my history and to do something about it. And so the things that I've been working on are part of my debt to Aboriginal family. And my children are beginning to realise that debt as well. And I hope that they will follow the family line and follow the family law, because there's a rich law, there's a rich cultural life, intellectual life to be followed, and they shouldn't pass it up easily. And my grandchildren are starting to show an incredible interest at the age of 6, and asking, what I'm pleased to say, are very intelligent questions about their history. And I feel, I'm not trying to distinguish Aboriginal people from the rest of Australian population, because every family is interesting and every Australian family has contacts with the ground. But we can't believe in a history of smoke and mirrors. The real history is so much more interesting, and we can all take a pride in our place in the country, whether it's Aboriginal or non-Aboriginal. We're all Australians, and we can love and appreciate this story.
What happens when you tell these stories at public gatherings?
Jaws drop. People go very quiet because often they're hearing something they'd never heard before, and it takes you time to absorb that information and assimilate it into your consciousness. So there are sometimes quite tense moments. I'm always very nervous because I know that I'm confronting people with something that their education didn't provide for them. So I'm also careful because I don't want to insult people. It's not, ignorance is no one's fault. People don't choose to be ignorant, they become ignorant. So the only way to avoid your ignorance is to be guided into an education. And Aboriginal elders guided their young people into an education. And our teachers and professors have this duty of care to our young people to guide them into it. You don't hit people over the head with an educational brick. You guide them into their education because it should be full of excitement and no horror.
Obviously, Aboriginal people are going to be very interested in what the kind of things you're talking about here. How about farmers? Do you hear from farmers in response to your book?
Well, farmers get the book straight away. They understand that a lot of the plants they're growing are European plants, which require European conditions. And so we, as farmers in this country, have to try and recreate European conditions, which is clearly impossible. And the stress on the Murray River is an indication that we're failing. Rivers without water in them are called streets. You have to have water in rivers. And it's such an obvious point that it must be telling us that when our river systems fail, streams that have been permanent right through thousands and thousands of years, when they fail, we've done something wrong. So we have to correct whatever that is. And growing some of these plants is a way of correcting that, because they don't require any more water than falls out of the sky.
What have you learned about the variety of Aboriginal housing that used to exist in this country?
Well, I was astounded by that, because I had been taught to draw Aboriginal houses, which was a bit of bark on a stick.
That lean
was,
too.
That
lean
was too, Aboriginal yeah. studies. Mm-hmm. And I did that right up until year 8, 9, 10. And I was ashamed to have copied that. Because really, when you think about it, there are so many obvious questions to ask about that. You know, why wouldn't you do something more sophisticated than that? Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you try to secure your food source? Why wouldn't you try and stay out of the rain? And, you know, we were just taught, oh, no, Aboriginal people, they were such wise and beautiful people, they decided to stay wet. But in fact, Aboriginal people were building sophisticated housing. And the dome structure is one of the world's great engineering principles. And it was probably came first here. But maybe, like bread, it occurs to the human species eventually. It just happened to occur to the humans in this continent first.
The dome distributes the weight of the roof down through its sides and down to the pillars of the or the sides of the house. That's the kind of engineering marvel. I think in Europe, the Romans, I think, were the first to come up with that. And there we see it in Aboriginal housing way back when. Stone houses. Stone houses, I never, ever, ever associate stone houses with Aboriginal people. I've never done that. And yet there's the evidence there for this?
Well, Lake Conda is one of the clear examples of stone housing in the country. And I wondered, I went and visited those houses, and I wondered whether this was just an aberration of having available basalt. So in studying the explorers' diaries and first settler diaries, I came across so many more references to stone dwellings elsewhere. And it wasn't just stone, it was the available material, whether it was timber. In Tasmanian case, it was whalebone as the structural material.
Whalebone, right.
The first, one of the first seamen to visit there on the west coast found these quite large houses made out of whalebone and incredibly strong. And yet, it's a wonderful thing to engage the curiosity of students, but sadly, no curriculum talks about it.
Were any of these buildings rendered in any way?
The renders were often clay and straw. Sometimes they were branches with fine twigs and leaves on them, which were also rendered to create structural integrity. Largely, it was a clay material. Sometimes it was animal skins. Quite often it was turf. In Victoria, people were cutting turf to make the roof structure. And so it became impervious to water. And the explorers like Collins and Batman and people like that talk about the warmth in those buildings because of the roof was so deep.
And these houses would often, well, sometimes be organised in villages, complex villages and large villages. So this is another thing that kind of blows my mind. The kind of frame that I grew up in, Aboriginal people wandered about, they had lean-tos, occasionally they'd gather for a corroboree in a clearing. No, there were permanent villages.
And you mentioned the Vikings before, and one of the great examples of a village up on the near Lake Mungo was that people were using a channel that they had enlarged and built their houses on either side of that channel. So it was like a little Venice because all the canoes were drawn up on the side. It would have been a beautiful place to live. And these obvious world examples like Vikings, like early Venice, they're equivalent because people were doing things to make their lives comfortable. And they were inventing the same sorts of things, watercraft, houses, crops, that humans all over the world eventually came to.
Bruce, you live on country now. Whereabouts is that?
I live at Gypsy Point near Mallacoota on the Victorian-New South Wales border. But I have Yuin connection in my family, and so I'm on Yuin country.
What sort of birds keep you company by that river?
Well, I've got a pelican that thinks he's either my brother or my father. I'm not quite sure which. But if he sees me on the jetty, because I'm known quite regularly to take a couple of stubbies of beer and sit down on the jetty as the sun sets, If he sees me there, he'll fly in, land on the jetty, and walk towards me and prop beside me and talk to me. And obviously, he probably thinks I'm pretty thick because I'm not always sure what he's talking about. But it's like, you know, it's having like having a wild friend. And I enjoy his company. He obviously finds mine okay.
Do you talk to him?
I'd speak to him in language.
Aboriginal language.
And I practice on him. You know, he's like my speaking coach. But if you live in the country, this sort of thing happens because you're surrounded by these wonderful creatures.
How would you greet a pelican in Yuin language? What would you say?
Marak Nguyen, Kungaji, Dedabul, Burungaba. You know, I hope you've had a great day, and I think you're a beautiful pelican.
Flattering a pelican is probably a good idea.
Well, they're nearly as old as us. In fact, some of them probably are. They've certainly had more children than us, thus their wisdom, and so we should treat them with respect.
Tell me about an encounter you had up in your area with a night heron.
Well, these are very wonderful creatures. And many of these birds are part of the spirit world of Aboriginal people. And these birds hunt at night. They're incredibly beautiful, incredibly shy. But I often see them on the riverbank. And if I'm fishing for prawn, I get a very close look at these birds because they're also fishing for prawn. So we're inhabiting the same region. And last year, one of these birds walked behind me because I was doing the human activity of fishing. He was doing the bird activity, which meant he needed shallower water than I had. So he walked behind me, and it was a night of phosphorescence in the water, one of those magical nights on the coast. And I could hear him, the drips coming off his toes as he stepped behind me. And when I turned around, I could see the phosphorescence dripping off his toes into the water. And I was transfixed. It was one of the great moments of my life to have a bird realise that I was there but ignore me and go about his fishing while I was fishing. And it, the mutuality in the activity couldn't be ignored, and I was very, very moved.
You mentioned that you and some of the other Yuin people in the area have started to cultivate these old grains that we've been talking about and the yams. How's that going, Bruce?
It's been fantastic, and we had a possible campaign to raise some money for this program, and I have to thank the ordinary Australians who contributed amounts of $50 and $100 to that program, because it allowed us to employ a young Aboriginal person who is now helping us to cultivate these yam, build the fences, and learn more about them, because there's a lot that we have to learn as Aboriginal people about what our ancestors did. Part of it we can get from talking to the elders. A lot of it we're getting from books and records from the explorers. But most of it is going to come from growing them again and recovering the culture and recovering the food. So we're grateful for the support we got from ordinary Australians to help us employ young Aboriginal people. We don't want to be dependent on government, because governments change and they have so many rules and regulations. But we've said to people, we just want to grow these things. We want young Aboriginal people to have a job that they can be proud of. We want them to be able to earn a wage and take that wage home and buy their kids food and drinks and live an independent life, on country, and providing something that other people want to eat.
Gee, it's been amazing speaking to you today, Bruce. I've learnt so much from this chat we've had. Really, thank you so much for coming on the program today.
My privilege, I must say that.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website
abc.net.au/conversations.